an alcoholic. My name is Omar Manajwala. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Omar Manajwala. All right. That's a great way to start a meeting. Billy, thank you for asking me to do this. And let me tell you, from the word go, I could tell that this was a solid AA meeting. First of all, I couldn't get in the door. I couldn't get in the door without people shaking my hand. And that's how it was for me when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. That means a lot. You know, the coffee was good. Got some water. Friendly group of people. So thank you for welcoming me. I am from the Outlaw Safecracker group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is in Richmond, and we meet on Monday nights at 8 p.m. and on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. It's another wonderful group, and we'd love to have you come down there. So I do have a sponsor, and he has a sponsor, and I do sponsor guys. And I have a sobriety date, which is the second most important day of my life. It's January 10th, 2001, and the most important day is today, and you people taught me that. You taught me how to live today. One day at a time. He gave me some guidelines. As a very undisciplined person, and by the end of this, I think you'll be convinced that I'm telling you the truth about that. So, I am an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. One of the ways that shows up is that part of me is intimidated by talking in front of you, and the other part is angry that you're not taking notes. So just be aware of that as I go through this. And I do have a friend in Charlotte who tells me that if I could drink like normal people, I'd drink all the time. And that's explains kind of, because I have a task today, which is to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I have another task, which is to tell you from my own point of view and in my own language how I came to develop a relationship with God. And I hope that I do that. Certainly will try to do that to the best of my ability today. Let me just get started. Also, I have the most important tool that a speaker can have. So I know that we're supposed to end this meeting by 9 p.m., right? All right, so I was born in Baltimore, Maryland, to Muslim parents. And I was raised as a Muslim. And Muslims don't drink alcohol. So there's more to the story, obviously, or else I wouldn't be here. Let me tell you that I was raised by very loving parents, although there was a time when I would not have told you that. There's a time when I would not have believed that, and I spent much of my life playing a victim. And I'll tell you a little bit about that because that's important to my alcoholism and may help you identify. But in my home, there was no alcohol. My parents went to great lengths in our home to ensure that there was no alcohol. The kind of lengths that we go to now. So there's no mouthwash with alcohol, right? Like in the doctor's opinion, no alcohol in any form. And we wouldn't have food coloring with alcohol. Certainly, if we went out to a restaurant, we would not trust anybody who told us that the alcohol cooked off. And when we had parties, there was never any alcohol. When we went to people's homes for parties, there was never any alcohol. So I was never exposed to alcohol. I did find a way to blame my parents for my alcoholism through this victim mentality, and I'm going to tell you about that too later so you can identify with that. But bottom line is, you know, I was raised in a very loving kind of a home. English is my second language, and even to this day I don't speak English with my parents. They come from India, and so we speak a dialect that's similar to Hindi. But as a kid, I always felt like an outsider. Now, I've seen a lot of people come up to the podium and describe how they felt like an outsider. And I can certainly identify with that because I felt like an outsider from the word go, long before I picked up a drink, right? I had my first drink at age 14, but I needed one long before that. And I know that's true today, looking back on it. And so I was laughed at for being an outsider, or that was my perception. And I was embarrassed about the fact that I was different. And so, you know, if kids came over, I didn't want them to see how our family was and what they did. And instead of what most people have, which is pride about their heritage and pride about who and where they're from. I was ashamed and would try to put up an exterior to show you, tough kind of exterior. But, I mean, even as late as the third grade, I was using the wrong words for things. I remember very vividly being laughed at for using the wrong word for a faucet. I was still using the word in my native language for that. And so I made an effort at that point to really learn English very well, and I tried to show off and work really hard academically. And it had nothing to do with an interest in anything or any of the kinds of reasons that you hear other people, a dream to, you know, to achieve something. No, it just had to do with showing off, essentially. That's what it was about. And so that's what I did. Now, when I was fairly young, I guess maybe sixth grade, I had a friend stay overnight, you know how we do, and we spent the night. We'd heard that there was a party going on, an outdoor kind of party, and my friend had suggested that, that there was going to be drinking going on and that we should find out who's doing this and turn them in. We got up in the middle of the night and put our shoes on and snuck out, as kids do. And I remember we cut through this path and came right up to the edge of the woods. And there they were, you know, the most beautiful thing I thought I had ever seen in my life. Eighth grade girls, you know, drinking and taking their shirts off. And it was just absolutely wonderful. And so my friend got out a pen and started writing down. He said, come on, we've got to write down the names of everybody here. And I just remembered feeling like I was on the wrong side of the bushes. I wanted to be out there. But it was a while before I took my first drink. I don't want to spend a lot of time, you know, getting to this. But I played lacrosse in high school. And I was very bad at lacrosse, and I don't say that in the way that, you know, we tend to joke from the podium of self-deprecating kind of humor. I really was very bad at the sport, so I never got to play. But one day, we were either ahead by a lot or behind by a lot, the coach took me off the bench and put me in the game. And I don't know what happened. I don't remember what happened. I probably ran around in circles. I know I didn't score. Nothing phenomenal happened. But everybody on the team was so excited that I actually got off the bench that they were going to take me out and get me drunk. I was 14 years old, maybe 15. And so I remember getting home thinking that I was the talk of the town. Everybody was going to take me out. I was going to get drunk, finally, the first time I was going to drink. And I was very excited about this, and I got a fresh change of clothes and a bottle of mouthwash, and I put it in the basement, and I unlocked the back door in the basement. And I tell you that story because I really was a liar long before I was a drinker. And that's why I tell you I needed my first drink long before I took it. And I had the characteristics of self-centeredness and self-seeking long before I picked up a drink. The drink was my solution. And it was, as I hope to share with you, a very efficient and effective solution for a long time. And so what happened was I got to this party. Now, I told you about the kinds of parties I went to as a kid, right? These were parties where your choices were Coke or Fresca. And so I got to this party. I'd never been to a party that charged an admission fee. And so I didn't bring any money because I didn't know you needed money when you went to a party. And so I offered my watch in trade for my first drink, which was a Schaefer's. And I remember this because, I'd heard a lot of people tell their story that they went up to the bar or whatever and saw what everybody else was drinking and tried to look tough and order up what everybody else saw. That wasn't my experience at all. I walked into the kitchen and the guy said, what are you having? And I said, how do you decide? I mean, there were so many drinks. I had no idea how you made a choice like that. How do you decide is what I said. And he said, well, here, have a Schaefer's. And I'll never forget this. I'll never forget it. He said, have a Schaefer's. It's the beer to have if you're having more than one. And I was. I was having more than one. I did not go to this party with the idea of finding out what alcohol tastes like. That was not my plan. I wanted what I saw the eighth grade girls had years ago. That's what I wanted. I wanted that change, that light in your eyes. And so I can tell you very little about the rest of that night. This is an open meeting. So there may be some non-alcoholics here, so there's really no way for me to fully describe to you what happened. However, I can just tell you this, that I went from a guy who was scared to talk to girls and scared to go up to people and feeling somewhat insecure, and by the end of those few drinks, I was transformed into somebody who was wondering which one of you all would be lucky enough to talk to me tonight. And that's what happened. The other thing I remember about that night is that I woke up in my own bed the next morning with a fresh change of clothes and minty breath. And that's important because it worked. My whole plan worked. Not only did I have a wonderful experience drinking that totally transformed me, but I got away with it without any consequences. I drank with impunity. All right, and that's what I did. And so, and that was amazing. That was really amazing. Something else happened that night, though. At that night, a true resentment against my family was born. Because, see, I was raised in a home where I was taught that alcohol was bad, and you shouldn't drink, and it'll destroy your life, and it's a sin, and you're a bad person if you drink. And so I had that message. And then, on the other hand, I had found an experience which had solved every problem I'd ever had. Every problem, feeling different, not able to talk to people, feeling insecure, insides, dying. Every problem I ever had was solved with alcohol. So, if someone told you to not use the one thing that would solve all your problems, you would have a resentment towards them. So, of course I did. I remember thinking to myself, the only explanation for this is malice. The only explanation my family would have for keeping me from the one thing that could solve all my problems would be malice. And so it was born a deep kind of a hatred towards what I now know to be, the most loving, supportive, caring family. And I don't want to fast forward too much, but today I have a great relationship with my family. But I do believe family are the final frontier, and this certainly was the hardest relationship to try and heal. And without this program and sponsorship, that would be a hopeless endeavor. I know that today. And there's lots of living amends in addition to the other amends that I had to make. Well, I didn't drink every day after that, but I certainly drank every chance I got. I'll put it to you this way. I don't recall any events where someone offered me a drink and I said, no, I'm good. It's okay, I'll pass. I don't remember any event like that. It may have happened. But senior week in high school was the purpose of senior week is to go to the beach in Ocean City, Maryland. I was from Maryland. To go to the beach and get so blot out drunk that you have no recollection of anything, just be drunk for an entire week. That is the purpose of senior week. I see some nods. Actually, it turns out that's not the purpose of senior week. Senior week is an opportunity to spend time with your friends, to celebrate a time. It's a transition in life. It's an opportunity to talk about what's coming next. It's a really loving, beautiful, engaging kind of week. Right? Not for me. All right, not for me. That wasn't my purpose for senior week. And I went there, and I achieved my goal, which was just in the first night to get rip-roaring drunk. And my friends, instead of being able to have a good time themselves, had to spend the first night of senior week babysitting me and debating whether or not to take me to the emergency room for alcohol poisoning. And they watched me to make sure I stayed breathing all night, didn't swallow my own vomit and all this kind of stuff. And that was their experience of senior week, the first night. That's the gift I gave them. And the next day, something really important happened, which is I swore that I would never drink again. And I meant it. I believe you could have given me a lie detector test, and I would have meant it. And at that point, I achieved some things in my life. I was doing kind of so-so in school, okay, and I was able to... there were different things I'd put my mind to that I was able to do. So I just figured that I ought to be able to do this, too, right? I decided to start drinking. I'd made a very conscious kind of a decision to start drinking. I'll decide to stop, right? And certainly didn't drink every day at that point, so I figured I should be able to do that. And I meant it. And within the next 3 days, I was drinking again. And I don't know if it was the same day or the next day or whatever. And that morning, by the way, after I was babysat all night, I woke up covered in vomit. And my first thought was, where am I and who vomited on me? And I really believed that everybody else was the cause of my problems. I couldn't have accepted that I had caused this in some way. Victim. Victim, victim, victim. And so I swore I'd never drink again, and I meant it, and I drank again. Now, the way I explained this to myself was by saying I'd made a hasty decision. And I was being impulsive about this whole affair. After all, I had many successful drinking bouts, right? Why would I take... I mean, it's not a sound decision to take so many wonderful drinking, you know, events and toss them out just because one time things went wrong. Certainly, I'd have to come up with some way to either switch. I switched from beer to liquor too quick, or maybe I should have, you know. So all these things, and I talked to some people who really supported that, and they were like, no. You did this, and you shouldn't have done this, and you shouldn't have done this, and blah, blah, blah. And I took careful notes and tried again. And I spent many years trying again, trying to recapture what I had that first time, that magic. And I'm not the kind of person who could never recapture that earlier magic. I did recapture it, and I loved it. And I love to drink, and I will not get up here at the podium and tell you I didn't love to drink, because let me tell you, I love to drink. And that would be dishonest to tell you that. But what happened was, I went to college, and in college I became a daily drinker. Now, I actually thought that that's what most people did. I thought that college was about daily drinking, and that as a side gig, you'd also get a degree. But really the main day, and I was certainly looked around me, and everybody around me was drinking every day. But that was because I had surrounded myself with people who drank every day. I look back now, and I communicate with some of the alumni and stuff. Turns out there's a ton of people in college who don't drink every day. There's no way you would know that except by doing a real autopsy and looking back at it. But it turns out that really is true, that there are a lot of people who don't drink every day in college. I know, it shocked me too. So... what happened at that point, though, is I really, at that point, I started to experience some real consequences of drinking. And at that point, it became clear that if you were looking for a roommate, I was a bad choice. I was a bad choice. If you were looking for a boyfriend, that was a terrible idea to date me. A terrible, that would have caused you tremendous pain. Not many people were looking for me for that reason anyway, but if you happened to be so unfortunate that you decided to give it a shot, or if I had convinced you, then your life would have been miserable. It turned out that I was not the kind of son you'd have wanted to have. I wouldn't have wanted to have that. I mean, in a way, I later learned, looking back, that I had harmed my family in so many ways, including not being there. But truth be told, I'm sure my family was grateful I wasn't around at times, often, considering the way I was behaving. That's not to say that I don't have to make amends for the fact that I wasn't there as a son. But, you know, at times I was so off the mark that really it was best to not have me around. Okay, that's also the time when you discovered it wasn't a good idea to loan me money. Okay, I didn't know what a loan was. My idea of a loan was a set of things that I would have to tell you to convince you that you would one day see the money again. Right? And if I successfully was able to say and do the right things to convince you of that fact, then that was a successful loan. Right? If I wasn't able to do that, then I had to move to the next target, the next mark. So, but there was never any idea in my mind that I would be paying anybody back any money. The question was ultimately, what could I tell you to convince you that you would get your money again? And so I became increasingly creative in that task. And I burned through. I'm not exactly sure how this happened, but at some point, and somehow, I ended up in medical school. And I used to say all kinds of things about how that happened, but today I look back and I realize I have no idea how that happened for someone like me. When I got to medical school is really a magical place. It turns out that you don't have to go to class when you're in medical school. As long as you take the tests, it's for the first 2 years. As long as you take the tests, nobody gives you any trouble. Nobody even asks you any questions. It's like a don't ask, don't tell kind of a thing. And So I did. That's when I became, and you know, in Bill's story, which is you know, the first chapter in that book that we read here if you're new, and that story, this guy, Bill Wilson, talks about how fear sobered him up for a while. Well, fear sobered me up for a while. And so I would be able to study really hard and take and pass these tests, and then I would just be off to the races again. And ego was a big part of this. You know, I would go into a bar, and I would take a credit card, and I'd buy drinks for everybody, and then I'd spend 7 years paying that off. That's the way that was for me. So that was in the early times when people were still convinced that extending me credit was a good idea. And they were later disabused of that thought. So what happened was in medical school was when I also... Now, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason that there can be coffee made and a door open and a meeting name and a schedule and a podium and a speaker and chairs folded out, this is my experience, is because of the traditions. So I'm very grateful to the traditions, and one of the traditions is that we have singleness of purpose. So I won't mention or discuss drugs from the podium. I'll just tell you which ones I did. All of them. All right, so, and that's all I'll need to say about that, and if it's helpful to you to know about that, I'd be happy to talk to you about that. But alcohol was the main gig there. And in the course of medical school and residency, I truly became a lone wolf, right? My story's a lot like this, yours probably, and the ones that you read about. And I became truly a lone wolf. I did things that were shameful, and like stealing from patients, and other kinds of things that were truly a violation of... But see, the thing is that I've heard a lot of people say that they didn't have a conscience when they were out there drinking. I can't identify with that. I had a conscience, and that conscience, not matching up with my behavior, helped me to drink a lot of beverage alcohol. It really made it possible for me to drink long and hard. And I was a bit embarrassed and ashamed of the things I was doing. And I really tried not to, you know, our actor can be quite virtuous. I really tried to conform my behavior to some more acceptable standards. Because I saw that I was paying the price for this kind of behavior. But I just couldn't do it. I couldn't clean it up. And during that time, I found out about things like the paycheck advance store. The paycheck advance store was very, very important to me because that was my way of drinking enough when I needed it. And I found out about things like airplane bottles, you know, the minis. And those were important to me, too, because when things were really getting bad, you knew that you could at least get something, you know. And then there were times when there wasn't enough for that, too, and terror. The terror of not being able to find the drink. I don't need to explain that to anybody here, probably. I also, and I've heard this described as alcohol abuse, so apologies to those who have that viewpoint, but I would buy a fifth of liquor and drink some of it and then pour the rest out as a way of trying to stop myself from drinking. And I'm not a dumb guy. But yet, the same day, I would find myself back at the liquor store buying more. And then pouring it out again and going back a third time. And that happened a lot for me. That was my best ability to use my brain to overcome a physical allergy that I have to this substance, right? I had no idea that it was a disease. Now, you might find that to be a little difficult to believe, considering that I was a doctor. And should have known, perhaps, that this was. Now, I understood that you all probably had a disease. That much I got. But for me, no way. I wasn't powerless, right? Powerless meant you had lost the power of choice. But I can think of dozens of times where I waited till after breakfast before I started drinking. I had plenty of choice and willpower left. So to me, it just, I thought that you had to be under the bridge. And found myself there at times, too. So something happened for me, And, by the way, in medical school, you had to go to an AA meeting, right? This is an open meeting. Maybe sometimes you see nurses or somebody showing up because they got to go to a meeting to see what it's like, right? So I was that guy in the back of the room. And I remembered being very angry at you when I came. And I heard what you had to say. And I remember that you said that you're fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And if you're not a member, don't put a dollar in the basket. And I remember that basket came around, and I put a dollar in the basket. Not because I thought I would be a member, but to prove to myself that you all were liars. Because you had just accepted a dollar from a non-member. And that undermined the legitimacy of your venture. You can keep the dollar. So that was something that that really was my degree of anger towards you all. And I hated you. And at one point before I actually really found sobriety, I did go to meetings. And I recall that I had gone to 5 meetings in one day, starting early. I was really desperate and wasn't sure how I was going to make it through this day without a drink. And it's possible to go to 5 meetings in one day in Durham where I was living. Actually, I wouldn't go in Durham because I was scared. So I went to, that I'd meet people I knew. So I went to Raleigh, Franklinton, Lewisburg, and in between those three I was able to pick up 5 meetings in one day. Now, I don't know, I mean, you know, it's not fair to those meetings to describe what an active drunk heard there. I don't know what they actually said, but I'll tell you what I heard, okay? I heard meeting makers make it. And so when I heard meeting makers make it, I thought, well, you know, I'm going to more meetings than anybody I met today. And then I heard it's a day at a time. And I thought, well, certainly if it's a day at a time and meeting makers make it and I'm going to more meetings than anybody I have met today, then I should be okay. And, you know, that evening after the 5th meeting, I got drunk. That's reality for me. I knew you guys were liars. I knew you weren't telling me the truth. And but I had a lot more drinking to do after that. I hit what I thought was another bottom. And it turns out, like, I was working in the emergency room. And if you're working in the emergency room, and things get busy, and I was the chief resident at a major academic hospital center. But if you're working in the emergency, well, at the time I wasn't the chief resident, but I was a resident there. If you're working in the emergency room and things get very, very busy, you're allowed to call another doctor for backup. And I had heard, I was on call this night, and I had heard that this guy was a recovered alcoholic. Now, he never told me that. I don't know how I knew that. Certainly didn't wear it on his sleeve. I just kind of knew that he was a member of AA. And so this night, I was truly desperate, and I called him up, and I said, I need some backup. And he came into the emergency room that night. It was like around 11 o'clock at night. And he came into the emergency room, and he looked around, and there were no patients to be seen by our service. And he was just perplexed, and he looked at me, and he said, you called me in for backup at 11 at night, and there's nobody to be seen. What's going on here? And I said, Dwayne, I'm an alcoholic. And he said, good. And I just remember thinking, what do you mean, good? And he was like, what he said was, and I'll never forget, he said, we were all wondering what was wrong with you. And I remember thinking, well, what do you mean? Why would that be good? And he said, well, this is something for which there's a solution. You know, there's a whole host of other problems for which there isn't one. So this is good news. I didn't get it. Then he did something that really irked me. He started telling me his story. And I remember thinking to myself, I brought you in to help me, and you're sitting here talking about you. And I remember thinking that. Like, what is your problem? And but then I couldn't help but listen. And, you know, he told these stories that made me realize I was just like him. And I couldn't believe it, because I knew he was a recovered alcoholic, but I had no idea that he had known what I had known. And I remember he told me the story, and I'll never forget it. He told me the story, and he said he came to on a street corner. And he wandered into a convenience store, and he said, can you tell me where I am? And the guy said, you're at the corner of Park and Vine. And he said, no, what city am I in, and where would someone like me park a car? And when he told me that story, I knew he drank like me. I knew he understood. that no matter how polished he was and how good he looked and the fact that he had a family and had put his life back together, and I thought he did it on his own. I didn't understand. Whatever it was, however clean and neat this guy looked at that moment, I knew he understood about the drinking game. Because he told me the stories about how I drank. And I knew I could trust this guy. I knew I could trust him. And so he said, let's go to an AA meeting together. And I said, I can't do that. And he said, why not? And I said, well, we've got patients. Our patients go to these meetings. Certainly, I'd be caught. I'd be found out, blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, I'm a doc, and patients go to the meetings I go to. I don't have a problem with that. And I said, well, it's different. You've got been sober for, you know, more than a decade, and, you know, I can't do that. And he said, well, all right. Let's go to a meeting out of town. And I said, I can't do that. And he said, why not? And I said, well, you know, we're a major academic hospital center. We get patients from all over North Carolina and Virginia. I could bump into somebody anywhere. He knew what was going on. He knew the deal. And he said to me, look, if you're ever serious, if you're ever really serious, and you want a way out, and I remember the words so clearly, he said, you want a way out, you call me. And he gave me his card with his phone number on it. And he said, if you're even thinking about stopping, call me. How will you know when it's time to call me? And I said, if I'm even thinking about stopping. He said, that's right. And he left. But I had two more years of bottoms to punch through. And a best definition of bottom I ever heard was from a guy who has over 50 years of sobriety, who said, hitting bottom is when things get bad faster than you can lower your standards. Well, I was lowering my standards very quickly, right? And so you hear about high bottoms and low bottoms. I believe that all that's crap. That's my experience. The bottom is when I just am unable to lower my standards any further. That moment occurred for me, fortunately. And I was living in Behama, North Carolina, which is about 10 or 12 miles north of Durham, in the middle of nowhere, in an old school teacher's house, which was basically a shack of sorts, with windows, a window on each of the walls, all four walls, four windows, so I could see anybody coming, and you know why that's important. So I had all that kind of set up. And I had to, let me just preface this, because you may not know about this, but you know how we will select jobs that greatly support our capacity to consume alcohol? Well, my situation was no different. You know, like they say, you know, there are more drinkers who know how to paint than painters who know how to drink, you know, or salesmen, for example. You know, it's the sort of job where you really can do what you need to do. So, and in fact, the reason I had selected my line of work, because I ended up actually going into a psychiatry residency, because in all the other residencies, you had to get up early in the morning. And I remember thinking, this is impossible for me. I was halfway through a neurosurgical, second neurosurgical sub-internship when I ditched it and said, forget it, I can't wake up this early anymore. And so, you know, I'd reached this point where I had a job. The job of chief resident, the only reason this is important to my story is that the job of chief resident is to sit at home and field calls from people who are upset and then call the residents and tell them how they screwed up. That is the job of a chief resident. Actually, it turns out that's not the job of a chief resident. A chief resident is supposed to educate and lead and teach people and support you and your career goals. Not for this alcoholic. So I was sitting at home. I had a job now at a major academic center where I could conduct 90% of my work from my bed. Perfect job for an alcoholic. And although I couldn't keep ahead of my rent, and I couldn't keep ahead of my bills, and I couldn't keep ahead of my groceries, and the paycheck advance door was really figuring in, and I was figuring some other ways to kind of make things happen, very shameful kinds of ways to get money together. I had reached a point where, that's the way I can describe it, and this might not be an accurate description, so apologies if it is, but I couldn't drink and I couldn't not drink. That's the best way I can explain it to you. I don't actually know if that's true or not, but that's kind of the best handle I can get on that. And I had reached a point where I believe believed I was going to commit suicide. I'm a doctor. I know how to kill myself. And I was in the process of doing that. Now, today when I look back on it, I realize I don't know if I would have done it. I mean, I'm a coward, really, at heart. I am. I didn't used to like to admit that when I first came in. It's like in Bill's story when he talks about how he has contempt towards the people jumping from the towers of high finance. Then he's staring the poison, cursing himself for a weakling. Then he's moving his mattress to the lower floors because he's scared he's actually going to jump out. That's my deal, right? Fear. And so so that's me. So I'm sitting here figuring that I'm probably going to get the guts to do this with enough booze in my system. And the phone rings, and it's my best friend in New York City. And so I tell him, well, look, you called at a particularly bad time. And he said, why? And for whatever reason, I told him the truth. I said, I'm just about to off myself. And I've talked to this guy since then. And what he said to me was, wouldn't you want to talk to your brother one last time before you did that? And I remember thinking, oh, yeah, I would kind of like to have a conversation with my brother before I off myself. Sounds like a good idea, I was thinking that and kind of getting a little buoyed up by that. Hung up the phone, called my brother in Memphis, Tennessee, who's also a doc. And he's non-alcoholic. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for non-alcoholics. I mean, there's no question that one alcoholic working with another alcoholic is the reason I'm here. But there are a lot of non-alcoholics who made it possible, too, and I know that's true for the early guys, too, Lois and all that. So what happened was I called my older brother in Memphis, Tennessee, and I said, look, I'm at the end of the road here. This is it. Game over. I'm done for. And he put me on hold. Now, I still don't like being put on hold, so some things don't change. And I have a problem with hold, and so patience and tolerance, I have some more work to do there. But when he clicked back over, he had bought me a plane ticket to Memphis, Tennessee. Come on out here, I'll help you. I had no idea that this guy could offer me any help. In fact, I figured he probably couldn't, and that this was really prolonging the inevitable. So I guess that's an act of God in my life, but I went. Drinking enough to make it on the plane ride and such, and drinking enough through the night to make it to the time that it was time to get on the plane in the morning, and then flying out there, he picked me up from the airport, and he detoxed me in his home. In one of these, what they call a frog, it's a finished room over the garage. He had one of these rooms. Yeah. And so he detoxed me up there, And I behaved in ways, he had kids in the home, and I cursed and shook and vomited and threatened and did all these things. And when it was over, which was a few days later, I think it was 3 days later, I came to, and I remember he sat on the edge of my bed, and he said, all right, so now what are you going to do? I had no idea. I had no idea. Because I had detoxed many times, and made all kinds of promises. And I felt like I was just through. And I had no way to convince anybody that I wasn't going to drink again. Certainly not myself. I knew that my situation was completely hopeless. And while there were other people who were able to get sober, I figured that couldn't possibly be me. I was just too bad. Too bad off. And so I just said, I don't know. And that was the truth. Finally some truth out of me, But then I remembered I had the number of this guy I'd met in the emergency room, Dwayne, 2 years before. And I called him up, and the number had changed, but I finally got a hold of this guy, Dwayne. And I said, Dwayne, remember when you came in that night 2 years ago? He said, where are you? I told him. And I said, you remember when you came in? He said, yeah. And I said, remember how you told me there was a way out? And he said, yeah. And I said, I need that right now. I can't wait another day. I need it now. Right now. And he said, well, I can help you with that. And I said, I don't think maybe you didn't hear me. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, I'm going to die, and I need a way out of this now. I can't wait. And he said, are you capable of following directions? And that's when I told my first lie in sobriety. And he told me to, my brother put me on another plane back to Durham, and I met him in the parking lot of a group that we were just talking about earlier, and went to my first real AA meeting, not the ones where I snuck the dollar in the basket or the five I went to in one day that I can't really recall, but, the real deal. And I showed up at this place, and you guys said, we're glad you're here. So I knew you were liars. Right? I'd already been convinced that you were liars. But when you told me you were glad I was here, I knew. And that's when I developed this sense that really, what you all do is you lie. You lie. And by lying to yourself enough, you manage to not drink. Because if you really knew who I was, you wouldn't be glad I was here. Nobody was glad I was here. Nobody was glad I was here. You told me to keep coming back. I figured that was another lie. Then you read these promises. I didn't know at the time that there were 9-step promises, but you read these promises. And I remember thinking to myself, no way, impossible, no way, no way, no way. All the promises, I heard them. And one I heard, I thought, well, maybe that's possible, but probably not. The rest of them, I was like, forget it. So you guys are a bunch of liars. And then there was a woman there who described herself as a grateful alcoholic. And she was glad to be an alcoholic. And I just wanted to punch her in the face. And I knew she was lying. Because anybody who had either that or she wasn't an alcoholic. Anybody who had what I had would not be grateful about anything, ever. And so I was fairly convinced that you guys were. But one thing I knew, that even though all of you were lying to me, that there was this guy who brought me to this meeting who drank like I did and didn't anymore. Seemed to have a happy, put-together life. So I didn't really care a lick for what you all were saying, but I knew that I had to stick close to this guy or I wasn't going to make it. That was just the end. He tossed me in a van and drove me up to treatment. Now, the only thing I'll say about treatment is that that's where I went. And it was a place where you went to meetings every day, and AA meetings every day. And so I did in the evenings. And about halfway, I promised Dwayne that if I was going to check out, I would call him. And I figured, well, I better at least try to start keeping the promises. And so I got a cold when I was in there, and they wouldn't treat it, so I was going to check out. And so I called him up, and I said, and I passed by this phone every day today, but I picked up this phone, and I called him up, and I said, I'm going to check out. I'm going to check out, and I'm going to get drunk. And he said, that's crazy. And I said, no, it's not crazy. The only reason I'm calling you is because I promised I would call you and tell you this. And he said, well, here's what I want you to do. I want you to set the phone down, go in the other room, get on your knees, pray, and ask if it's God's will for you to stay sober or to get drunk. And I said, well, I don't believe in God. He said, I don't care. You know, you came to me to ask for directions. I don't remember the exact wording, but it was something like that. I just want you to go over there and talk to whatever. Get on your knees and say a prayer. And he said, and if it turns out that it's God's will for you to leave treatment and get drunk, I want you to use my will and stay in treatment anyway. And I remember thinking, how could this make any sense? You know, it's just totally craziness. But I did it. And I went into this other room, and I got on my knees, and I said a prayer to a God I did not believe in or didn't think I believed in. Today I don't believe I was an atheist, although at the time I believed I was. I got on my knees, and I said this prayer, and something happened. And I don't want to convince, I don't want to send a message like I had some burning bush type of, I believe my spiritual awakening was of the educational variety for me. But something changed for me. And best explanation I can give you is that when I came back to talk to him on the phone, I realized that I wasn't going to get a cell phone call from God or a burning bush or a lightning bolt. What I was going to get is you guys helping me, at least to start with. And that here was a guy on the other end of the line speaking some sanity from his experience. And I stayed, and I kept going to meetings. I got home, back to Durham, and when I got home, I went back into the school teacher's house, and I called my friends and said, hey, listen, could you clear out all the alcohol out of the home? And you know, they did that for me. There were people who really did care about me, and they shouldn't have. I never understood why people were nice to me. And in fact, I remember thinking at times that generally people are confused about the purpose of life. And I'll give an example of how I got convinced of this. I was driving. Actually, it was years ago, and I was driving down 29, believe it or not, because I had a drinking buddy in Charlottesville at the time. I lived in Baltimore. And I was driving down this road, and I had a flat tire on 29. Somewhere around here, I'll never know where. A couple of guys, they were brothers, came out, and it was late at night, and they fixed my tire. They lived here in town. They saw me, and they fixed my flat tire. And I remember thinking to myself, thank you, but you are so confused about the purpose of life. Right? The purpose of life is not to help people who are having problems. The purpose is to get your own. And I remember looking at these people and thinking, thank God there are morons like this in the world. And that was how selfish I was. And so, you know, so long and short of it is that, you know, I was completely confused. At one point, I went to see a psychiatrist. And I went in to see the psychiatrist. It was a student health service. And I said, and the nurse asked me what the problem was. I said, I ain't talking to anybody but the psychiatrist. So they let me go back to see the psychiatrist, and I sat down with the psychiatrist, and I said, and I was in medical school at the time, and I said, he said, what's the problem that you won't tell the nurse? What really is the problem here? And I said, everybody in the world is a moron. And he kind of looked at me with that same kind of expression that you have, and he said, why is it that you're here in the psychiatrist's office then? And I said, I need some assistance in coping in a world that's filled with morons. That's the way I really viewed it, that the problem was yours. I had no way of viewing that the problem was mine. So I got back to my home, and I'd asked my friends to clear out the alcohol, and I opened my fridge, and behind two boxes of the three-month-old pizza, there was a bottle of vodka, a couple bottles of vodka, actually. And I got scared, and I left my home immediately and went to an AA meeting. And it was you guys who came back to my home and poured that out for me. That's what you did for me, because I didn't have the capacity to recoil at that time. You did it for me. And since then, you've done a ton of things for me. And so that's why I love coming to a meeting like this, where the guys are out there shaking the hands and with the coffee made and all that. That's the spirit that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with, and it's my hope that I don't believe it needs to be changed. You may. This is just my experience. I don't think it does. So I went to another meeting, and it was in the directory, and it was on Saturday morning in Alston Avenue in Durham. And I walked into this meeting, and there was just one woman sitting there, African-American woman, with a pot of coffee and a big book. And I said, is this the AA meeting? And she said, yes, it is. And she got out her cell phone and called some people, and people showed up, and we had a meeting. I thought that was pretty cool, so I went back a few more times, a few more Saturdays, in addition to going to other meetings. I later found out that that was not an AA meeting, that what had happened was that meeting had folded because they couldn't get enough attendance. But they made a group conscience to post an alcoholic in that room for in case somebody came in. And so that's why that woman, Mac, was there, in case somebody had an old schedule and was looking for a meeting. Now, I'm going to look at that woman doing that kind of behavior, and then I'm going to turn down an AA service request? I don't think so. Not if I want to stay sober. I went to a meeting called the Oakley meeting, which is now defunct in Durham, and someone said, who wants to stay sober? And I raised my hand, and I felt some metal against my chest, and it was a coffee pot. And I had no idea what making coffee had to do with staying sober, right? One thing is service work, and the other one is trying not to consume a beverage. What could this have to do with this? Didn't make any sense to me. That's important because, see, a lot of people told me, you're going to have to do things you don't want to do to get sober. All right. Well, the truth is I was doing things I didn't want to do when I was out there drinking. I did lots of things I didn't want to do when I was out there drinking. So that was not really a new skill that I needed. In fact, that's really not the skill I needed. I needed to do things that I didn't even think were necessary. Things that just struck me as being a little extra or not really even needed. I needed to be willing to do things that didn't make sense to me. Do those things simply because they were suggested to me. And for no other reason. Not run them past the filter of my brain. Because what my brain told me at that moment was, this room is filled with 29 other alcoholics who are not washing this coffee pot. They're staying sober without cleaning the coffee. I ought to be able to. At least for today, and it's a day at a time, right? That's what my brain was telling me, right? So, if I had done that, if I had followed my brain and decided that all suggestions have to make sense to me before I take them, you would have a different speaker tonight. I promise you that's true. I did these things even though I thought they were completely unnecessary, simply because they were suggested. And I know for a fact that that's not because I'm anything special. Because there's no way I could have convinced myself, oh, do things that don't make sense to you. No, of course not. That's a gift. That's a gift from God. And I don't know today why I have it and the guy that's calling me up drunk at 3 in the morning doesn't. I don't know where the willingness, I don't know why I got the willingness. Best explanation I ever got for why I got the willingness was from a sponsee who told me, you must have had that willingness to help me. That's the best explanation I've ever gotten for why I've got it and why the next guy doesn't. I have no idea. That's, you know, those are the unanswerable questions as far as I'm concerned. But I have a wonderful life today. I got a great home group. I should mention the steps, right? I took the steps under the direction of a sponsor, you know, and we said our third step prayer together, and I got cracking on a fourth step. And when I finished the fourth step, I didn't want to take a fifth step. And I was very scared to take a fifth step. And there was a guy named Danny B. He was probably there the night that you went to the Durham Central group. But Danny would come up to me at every meeting and ask me if I had done my fifth step yet. And I won't say at the podium the words, the choice words I had for this gentleman. But I did, and I really did curse this guy out. Then one day I remember, because it was July 3rd, 2001, he came up to me and he put $2 in my hand, just as the Serenity Prayer was finishing at the beginning of the meeting. And I leaned over and I said, what is this for? And he said, you go across the street and get yourself a drink. You're not serious about this. Now, I don't recommend that. I'm not saying that somebody else should do that. I'm just telling you my experience, that this guy put $2 in my hand, and the next day I took my fifth step. That was what it took for me. And the next day I took that fifth step on July 4th, 2001. And just like in the book, returning home took an hour. I mean, you know, I'm not going to belabor that. And then made a list and started making amends. And I had some amends where I was kicked out of the office. And I had some amends where an honest letter had to be sent. But all the money got deposited. All right, because these people, my sponsor explained to me, these people didn't want my money. They wanted their money. And that was a very, very important concept, because I was very confused about, you know, this stuff in my pocket was like poison. Anytime I got a buck that didn't belong to me, that was like a poison. And everything I was getting didn't belong to me for a long time. Well, I've got a great home group today and wonderful experiences. I have a relationship again with my family, which I would have told you would have been impossible. I already told you I believe family are the final frontier. And when I work with guys, it seems to be the same for many. And those are the hardest amends to make. And a lot of times the most important, at least for me, I'm saying. And I do. I have a relationship with them. And I have a relationship with my brothers. I'm engaged. That's a miracle for someone like me. I have a home group where if I don't show up, people call me. All right. But usually that's not necessary because I've called them to let them know what's going on. Like I might be speaking somewhere else or have to work or something like that. But otherwise I try to show up. And I got a cell phone. You don't need a cell phone to stay sober. But I'd like to show off that I have a cell phone that's filled with numbers of members of Alcoholics Anonymous so that I can take a 10th step during the day if I need to promptly discuss it with somebody. And that's so important to me. And, you know, I see lots of people get sober where most of their friends are not members of AA. And I believe that's okay. But my experience is most of my friends are members of AA. They just are. Doesn't have to be that way for you or anybody else, but I love it. I love it because then if something's going on or something's happening, you know, I can call. But much, much more importantly, I can call you and ask you how you're doing and see if I could be helpful to you in some way. Now, that is not a thought that generates from within me on most days. That's directions. I'm an undisciplined guy. I promise you, ask any of my friends, they will tell you I'm a very undisciplined kind of guy. I need to let God discipline me in a way that's outlined in through the steps in the book. And my sponsor has described me as the kind of guy that would try to think my way out of a burning building. My noggin spins really fast. Brainstorm. I heard Eric, appreciate guys coming up and supporting me, Eric and Lincoln. I heard Eric describing how the brainstorm, you know, that thought that comes, the grouch and the brainstorm are not for us. That's what happens to me. My head starts spinning and I come up with 1,000 reasons why I shouldn't have to follow these suggestions. But fortunately, I have sponsorship and the support of a solid home group, a book that has instructions. It's a pretty remarkable experience. I got friends. I only mention this as one of the blessings of sobriety, but I actually get to be the doctor in the treatment center that I went to. And I pass by that phone and that room every day where I made that phone call to my sponsor and said I was going to check out and get drunk. I get to see that every day. And that's got nothing to do with AA. I'm firmly convinced that if I confuse my work with my AA life, you might as well just write me off. I'm done for. And in fact, I'm much more interested in AA than I've ever been in work, in any work. And so that's just an honest admission to you. And but I do, and today, to me, what I really have today is friends. You know, and I have friends because I know how to be a friend. And I know how to be a friend because you showed me how to be a friend. You called me up and asked me how I was doing, and my first thought was, you're another one of these people like the tire flat fixers who's confused about the purpose of life. And today I call you up and I ask you how you're doing. And I'm impressed when you reach your hand out to me, like you did when I walked in through the door tonight. Billy, thank you for having me tonight.